Morning, everyone. No, the parsha that we read yesterday has over 50 mitzvos, more mitzvos than any other parsha of the Torah. 1/12 of the Torah is in this parsha, so it's impossible to pick any significant number of mitzvos. So I do want to just talk about two things. I want to talk about the first mitzvah in the parsha and the second one. The first one is the ethically very, very difficult parsha of Eishes Shefas Torah. And the second one is the rebellious son. I'm going to start with the second one first because that's a shorter piece I want to share with you. That is, the Torah describes the story of a rebellious child. And according to Chazal, the child is less than bar mitzvah. He's not 13 yet. And the child, you know, didn't commit mass murder or anything. The child basically stole food and alcohol from his parents. Perhaps we've experienced this before. The parents bring him to Beis Din and say, this is a rebellious child. And there's actually a procedure where the child is killed. He is stoned at the gate because of his rebelliousness. Now the Gemara explains in Sanhedrin that the Ben Sora Umora is not killed because of the sins he committed, because even if an adult steals, it's not a capital crime. But he is what is called Nidon Al Shem Sofo. He is punished not because of what he did, but because of what the Torah testifies he will do if he's allowed to continue, that he'll start off with stealing. Eventually he will rob people in the street, and eventually he will murder. So the Torah makes a judgment, an amazing judgment. Yomus Zakai, kill this child when he is still in a state of relative innocence. The Al Yomus Chayev. Now, it's important to make the point that only God can make such a judgment. God forbid, it is not possible for a human court to make the judgment. Hashem is telling you, under these circumstances, this is what's going to happen. For me to look at any other case and say, oh, he's going to be bad, there's not going to be any hope, that would not be within the purview.
What kind of teaching about the Rambam? Because the opportunity is not given here.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a moment. Well, all I can tell you is that in Israel you get to hear everything, and I don't want to repeat it, but it's not worthwhile to repeat, but okay. So let me just mention the famous question that the Marsha asked. The Marsha asked the question that we see that the Ben Sora Umora is punished. It's not even punishment technically, it's really just to get him out of the way, not because of what he did, but because of what he will become. We find by Ishmael exactly the opposite idea, that when Hagar was banished from Avram's house and she took Ishmael, and Ishmael was dying of thirst, and Hagar prayed, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed Hagar to see a well, and the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that the angels were saying in heaven, why are you saving Ishmael? The future generation shall oppress the Jews. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Asher Husham, I judge people not by what they will do in the future. I judge people by the way they are now. And right now, although Ishmael is not exactly a tzaddik right now, but right now he didn't do anything that is deserving of death. So the Marsha says that the whole idea of Asher Husham, Hashem judges you by what you are right now. Hashem does not look into the future and punish you based on future. L'chaira, the Ben Sora Umora is a direct contradiction to Asher Husham. So we have two principles that seem to be in contradiction. One is Nidon Al Shem Sofo, and the other is Asher Husham. Which is it? Both principles cannot be totally correct. So the Marsha himself gives a distinction between the person himself who will do evil versus the descendants. The Yishmael paradigm simply says Hashem will not destroy Yishmael because his descendants will persecute the Jewish people. But the Ben Sora Umora, Hashem is making the judgment, and Hashem knows, of course, that the Ben Sora Umora himself is going to be the one that is going to murder. At that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could take the future into account. You may recall, perhaps you read years ago, the Roald Dahl short story. It's a very, very interesting story. It's a thought experiment about a doctor that is summoned, you know, in the middle of the night, and a mother has a baby, and the baby is so cute and beautiful and curly hair, and the baby can't breathe. It has pneumonia or bronchitis, something very, very severe. And unless the doctor takes care of the baby will die. And the mother is pleading and begging the doctor to take care of this baby, to give the baby medicine or do whatever could be done. So the experiment goes, let's say you knew with a certainty that this baby was Adolf Hitler. This baby was going to grow up and kill 6 million Jews, and a few million other people as well, by the way. So the question becomes, what do you do? Right now it's a beautiful, cute, adorable baby, and the mother is begging for mercy. But you know, and of course we never know, that's the point, but you know, this is the experiment, you know. And that's exactly why the Torah says by Amalek, you kill the men, women, and children. Amalek. What type of Rachmanis is it to kill babies? The answer is, Hashem is telling you, these babies are going to be Hitler. But again, I want to make a point. It's only HaKadosh Baruch Hu that can make such a judgment. Because Hashem's knowledge of the future is total. We could never write off a person. We certainly could not say by the Chayalim. That's why that is such a repulsive statement. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes the statement based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's knowledge of the future. We don't know. And certainly, how many people have become Baal Tshuva? How many people are Chozer B'Tshuva? Even if a person is not a complete Baal Tshuva, the mitzvahs that a person does, even if they're very few mitzvahs, could be so tremendous. And the zechus of serving Am Yisrael can be so tremendous. So that's really pretty much of a horrendous statement. And I'm afraid that crazy people could take it one step further and say, oh, if it's better for them to be dead, let's go around and kill a few. You know, you never know. In this very heated atmosphere, all sorts of irrational and perverse philosophies get espoused. Okay. But the Gemara then says the following. After it discusses the halachos of Ben Sora Umora, there's a rabbi that says, such a case has never happened in history and will never happen. Lo haya v'lo nivra. It is just a theoretical construct. Another rabbi said, it happened. I was there and I sat on his grave. Now, how do you reconcile that machlokas? We normally like to say in all machloksim, they're both right. But here, one person says, a Ben Sora Mora never happened. And the other says, I sat on his grave, it did happen. Okay. Right now, that's a difficult question, but I want to focus on a different point. Part of why the Gemara says it'll never happen is there are some halachic technicalities that are so hard to meet that you'll never get it. One of the technicalities is that father and mother have to have the same voice. Their voice has to be the same. Einenu shomea b'koleinu. He does not listen to our voice. That is lashon yachid, not koloseinu. And as a result, since it's very unusual, if not impossible, I suppose, for a husband and a wife to have exactly the same voice, then, by definition, you're not going to have Ben Sora Umora. And I'll come to what the meaning of that is. Is it just an inexplicable Gezeira Sakosov? Or is there some meaning there? Now, a second point, which is not so rare, in fact, most of the time this condition will be met, is there's another Gezeira Sakosov, that if either parent is hard of hearing, if either parent cannot hear, there's no din of Sora Umora. You have to have two hearing parents. Now, again, that's not a rarity. Most of the time, two parents will be hearing. But Lamaisa, if any of the parents, in fact, that would be a way for the Ben Sora Umora to get out of, well, in a way, he'll be Chayav Misa for another reason. If he's going to be sentenced as a Ben Sora Umora, so he could whack his mother or father in the ear, give them deafness, and then he would be exempt. Now, of course, you would think, well, that's not going to work, because if you hit your parent, you're chayav misa. But that is going to work, because you're chayav misa for hitting a parent only if you're bar mitzvah. Ben Soru Mora is chayav misa at 12 and a half. So if a 12 and a half hits his parents, it makes him deaf. We're making devious plans here. So he is exempt from the law of Ben Soru Mora, and he's not chayav misa for hitting his parent. So this is kind of rabbinical legal advice to get out of the sentence. But okay. But I want to focus on these two requirements. Father and mother must have the same voice, and father and mother must both be hearing people. What message is that telling us here? So there actually is a very powerful symbolic message that is being communicated. The Ben Soru Mora represents the epitome, or maybe the nadir, the bottom, of the situation without hope. The kid that is simply written off. The kid in which we say, he is so evil, so bad, bad seed. Right? We come across this sometimes and we wonder about it. Is there a point of no return? Right? We do believe in tshuva. We do believe in change. We do believe that everybody has redemptive potential. Everybody has the potential for good. But then you sometimes come across these 10-year-olds that just go around, you know, killing people. Like, what do you do? What do you do with it? So the Ben Soru Mora is the ultimate statement that there are going to be times, very rare times, that indeed there's nothing that we can do. There is a hopeless situation. Very, very rare. Lo hayo v'lo nivra, but very rare. At least theoretically on the books. But the Torah's merame is the following. In order to condemn a child as having no hope, it is only if the parents did what they're able to do to raise that child. And, number one, let's take the deafness first. When father or mother are deaf to their own message, they give mussar, they give tochacha, they give guidance, they give education, but they don't hear what they're saying. They don't take in the teachings of the Torah. Their chinuch is, do as I say and not as I do. Then you can't blame the child for whatever the child turns out to be, because the child never had a chinuch that was consistent with the behaviors of the parents. And this is a very big nisayon. You know, Rav Huttner used to say, you know, in America, in a, I think in Eretz Yisrael, it may be less of a problem, but maybe it depends on the shul. Talking in shul is a very big problem in many American Orthodox synagogues. And it's very interesting. It's almost a unique phenomenon to shuls. You know, in churches, that doesn't happen. Nobody talks in the church. And in fact, there was a classic article in one of the Lincoln Square newsletters. You must have come across this. This is really a classic article where a woman was writing. It's a woman who was a great fan of old movies. She used to go to classic movie theaters. And she said she had two temples in her life. One was the temple of popular culture that she greatly enjoyed, and the other is the temple of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And she was describing the difference in behavior in the two temples. In one temple, there's reverential silence. No one dares to say a word. No one talks. You watch with intensity every single thing that's unfolding. In the other temple, people walk in and out. They come late. They talk. And then she says, guess which temple is which? Of course, the movie theater, nobody dares say a word, you know, during Casablanca or whatever it is. But be it as it may, so Rav Huttner used to say that parents who interrupt their conversation to tell their children to keep quiet are teaching their child that when he or she grows up, they will tell their child to keep quiet. But the only way you can teach your child to keep quiet is by you yourself being quiet. And in a way, that makes parenting very, very difficult, because the Sfarim tell us, all of us have a Yetzer Hara for ourselves, in terms of doing mitzvahs, you know, we don't like to push ourselves, but we don't have a Yetzer Hara for our children. We want our children to be tzaddikim, chassidim, masmidim. But the problem is, you really cannot expect a child to come out better than you are. Now, sometimes it certainly happens. Hashem gives you a gift. But that's l'mayla min ha'teva. Certainly it can happen. But b'derech klal, if you want to have a good child, you have to be not only a good parent, You have to be a good Jew. You have to be an Oved. You have to be a person who works on your Avodas Hashem. You have to be a person who grows in Torah and Mitzvahs. You have to be a model that your children look up to. And they see a person who works on Bein Adam LaMakom and, double underline, Bein Adam LaChaveira. And then you're, in fact, it's brought down in Sfarim that part of the mitzvah of Kibud Avayim, which is a mitzvah on a child, is that there's a mitzvah on a parent to make themselves people who are worthy of honor. Make yourself an honorable parent. Now granted, a child has to have kibbutz no matter what the parent is. That's true. But in order to help the child do that mitzvah, you have a chiyuv to become a mechubat, a person deserving of honor. Do you want to say?
Yeah.
Right.
He said that's not what it means. What it means is when you see your children modeling your worst character traits,
yep.
That's the worst
star. That's the worst. Right. You get a video of all the things you did wrong that you were able to cover up. Yeah, there's a whole poem. I once came across this poem about little eyes are watching you all the time. Children really are video machines. They see everything. They sense everything. They understand everything. Even before they can articulate things in verbally, they just know, and maybe they can't even say what they know, but they know what's going on. So, when you give your child a whole drush about not cheating in school or something, and then when there's a phone call, you tell your child, just tell him at home, I don't want to talk to him. You know, what is going on over there? And the child picks it up. You know, we as adults, we have the sophistication to give terutzim, give answers, give excuses, give tilpo, you know, we could be mafalpel in all sorts of different ways. Kids see it very, very straight, remarkable. Very, very straight. So consequently, that's the message. If the parent is deaf to their own message, you can't blame the kid for not following it because he didn't have a chinuch that was consistent. I remember years ago, I was once at a Board of Education meeting for a Jewish school. And the school, you know, it's an American school. It wasn't like a cheder here, but the school, you know, had school till 5 p.m. And they were discussing what extra learning could they give for the kids. What extra learning? A mishmor and this and that. And I was cynically in my own thoughts, and I was thinking to myself that I knew what some of the parents did at night, and it wasn't necessarily learning. And I'm thinking, you know, instead of thinking about what extra learning you could put on your kids who are already very tired after a full day of school, why don't the parents do a little extra learning? And maybe that might inspire the kids more. You know, so all of this is a very important idea. And again, it's very hard. You want to be a good parent, you got to be a good person. You want your parent to be good, righteous Jews, you have to be a good, righteous Jew. Right? You can't sit back and simply say, be a tzaddik. Right, we have to try to beat tzaddikim according to our madrega as well. That's the message of deafness. That if they're deaf to their message, they can't condemn the child. Now, what about the idea that father and mother must have the same voice? So halachically, it actually does mean they have to talk the same. But allegorically, symbolically, it expresses the message of consistency. Father and mother have to be on the same page. Now, to be on the same page absolutely does not mean that the parenting styles of fathers and mothers are the same. They are not the same. They are not supposed to be the same. Men and women are very different. HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'davka created the human relationship to be a composite of a man and a woman precisely because each person brings uniqueness to their Avodas Hashem, and the shleimus of a bias is only with the feminine and the masculine components united. So the concept is not to create a unisex situation where father and mother are simply clones of each other and doing exactly the same thing. You know, traditionally, at least in the secular world, you know, mom was the easier parent and dad was the disciplinarian. Wait until your father gets home was the famous refrain of the 50s and 60s. Today in many homes it's actually the opposite. Dad tends to be a little more lenient because maybe he's around the kids a little less, more relaxed. But so certainly the techniques and the methods could be very, very different. But the fundamental yesodos of a bias, what is important in our home. What are we trying to raise our children with? Avas Torah, Avas Yisrael, Yiras Hashem, Avas Hashem. Resilience, optimism in life, which are again very, very important qualities. Called Simchas Achaim. It's a new phrase, brother. Simchas Achaim is not a phrase that appears. I hear it used in around the, over the past decade or so. But even if it's a new phrase, it's not a classical phrase, but it does express the value of because really Simchas Achaim stems from Emuna and Bitachon. That's really the source of everything. Because when a person has Emuna and Bitachon, that Hashem cares about them, and Hashem loves them, and Hashem is dictating their lives, then even when things are tough, you know that it's for a purpose, you know it's for Tov, and that can give a person joy, even in difficult challenges, that I have a challenge, but I'm going to work through it. Now, the Baal HaTanya writes, by the way, that joy can exist simultaneously with sadness. Judaism, unlike Buddhism, does not deny the reality of suffering. That's why we have avelus, you know, we cry, we mourn, we rip kriya. We don't say suffering is an illusion. We don't say it's fake, we say it's real. And we are supposed to experience it. But side by side, in a way that's difficult to articulate, there can also be an inner joy that I know that no matter how hard my life is, it is not senseless. It is not pointless. It is not just an accident that happened, a freak occurrence. Things are directed, things are guided. And therefore, as the Baal HaTanya writes, side by side with a broken heart, and we have that broken heart, can exist a certain serenity and security and resilience that my life has a purpose and my life has a meaning. Therefore, the Simcha Sachayim actually comes from Emuna, because when there's Emuna, there will be Simcha. Because when a person doesn't have Emuna and you think things happen accidentally, random, chaos, then you live a life of fear because you don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it'll be this earthquake, this terrorist attack, and it'll be senseless without purpose. That gives a person panic and anxiety. So, be it as it may, these are the values that a parent wants to teach. And going back, if you're not consistent, if father and mother don't share the same hashkafas, once again, the kid is confused. The kid is inconsistency. When there's inconsistency, a child cannot be a ben sora or mora. So this is a fascinating example that from the technicalities of the halacha, you can actually derive some very important principles in how we raise our children. Yeah.
How, when, or do you apply the description of ben sora or mora when you have a large family, good parenting skills, all the children except one?
Yeah.
You know, and you just don't know the reason. And do you even call that, let's say they go walk to Dara, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, Ben Somar is...
The rest of the siblings are fine. You know, the parents...
Well, listen, these are difficult issues. And as you know, in recent years, we've identified the phenomenon called kids at risk. Some people don't like that.
No. Not at risk, beyond the risk.
Listen. I mean, before a child is written off as being hopeless, you really have to exhaust every possible avenue. Now, there are avenues. Sometimes the avenues might be very extreme. Sometimes a child maybe would not live at home. There are yeshivas, there are placements, there are programs. One has to be very, very careful. But I will tell you that, I don't have, you know, an amazing amount of experience, but I have some experience with kids in this situation. And so, I'm not going to say, you know, love will conquer everything, as the secular saying has it. But the truth is that with love coupled with discipline and with the right psychological guidance, there is a lot of hope for children. You know, here in Yerushalayim, we have yeshivas that specialize in kids who just were kicked out of, you know, a million places, kids on drugs, kids on alcohol. In my own yeshiva, I know people who were, drug addicts and the like. I mean, Orzbech doesn't take them from the addiction point, but whatever it is, they got the help that they needed, and they became very fine B'nai Torah. So things that look hopeless, there's much, much hope, but you have to couple it. It's a combination of love and discipline, basically, because love alone is not going to work, because the love is just enabling. We know for all addictive behaviors, you become, what do they call it, codependent or whatever it is. by just enabling the person to keep on going. There has to be a toughness and there has to be a structure, but it has to be totally connected with a deep love and care for the child, you know. And Baruch Hashem, I mean, there have been many, 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 many successes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does allow those miracles to happen. So I would not be overly loose in using the I mean, listen, I was once called a Ben-Sorah. I mean, I wasn't doing anything, but it was just a matter of speaking. Sometimes we'll just use the expression. It's only an expression, yeah. Since I didn't learn the Chumash yet, so it didn't even register with me anyway, so I didn't take it too negatively. But okay. But again, as I say, Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of hope. And the point is, don't give up. You just don't give up. But as I say, the difficult issue is that if you have other children, you do have to be concerned for the other children. That's a very, very difficult balance. I don't give up on this child, but I also have to be concerned about this child not destroying the rest of the family. So you have to figure out some way of balancing those two ideas. Okay. Now, let's go backwards to Eish HaShefas Toar. And of course, by the way,
your question about... Someone said
there
was never such a case, and someone else said...
Yeah, I didn't answer it, but I'll give you an answer. The answer that I would give you is this. There are arguments in the Gemara about the conditions that need to be met when there's a Ben Sowa Mara. So I would suggest that maybe the point is this. Everybody admits a kid was executed because he was accused of being a Ben Sowa Mara. But the one who said it never happened is saying it was not a halachically proper execution, because the condition wasn't met. In other words, they're not arguing over what happened, they're arguing over whether it had a halachic validity. Right? That could be a way of understanding the machlokas there. Okay. Now, let's go backwards, going back to the beginning of the trip. And that's where we read the story of taking the captive woman in time of war. And by the way, Rashi points out that the reason why it's juxtaposed to Ben Sowa Umora is, yeah, we may have given you a heter if you follow all the procedure, but don't think anything good is going to come out of it. You're going to get a Ben Sowa Umora and the like. So it's not a good thing to pursue. Yeah. Yeah, there's a part before that about the hated wife, yeah, but it's a continuum, the hated wife, and then the Ben Sowa Umora and the like. But the parsha of Yefas Toar is a very, very perplexing parsha, and I'm not even going to address it because I really want to share with you an allegorical pshat, which is not connected to the literal meaning at all. But essentially, it does allow in time of war a Jewish man to take a non-Jewish woman to have intercourse with her. Now, according to many commentaries, we are not talking about rape. It's important to emphasize that. We are talking about a consensual encounter. That's very important. This is not an authorization of rape, God forbid. But even if it's not, so Baruch Hashem, that makes it a little better, it's still a non-Jewish woman without marriage in time of war. So he's allowed, the way the Rambam learns, one bite, so to speak, one free activity. But if he wants to continue the relationship, he's not allowed to until she goes through a whole ceremony, which is designed to actually make her repulsive to him. She has to shave off her hair, and she either cuts her fingernails very short, or according to the other interpretation, they grow very, very long. She must be left to cry for her father or mother 30 days. And then, if you want to marry her, you can marry her. If you don't want to marry her, you can no longer keep her as a slave or sell her. She must be set free because you put her through this form of abuse. Now, besides the theological problem, it's even hard to figure out what's going on here, because what happens after the 30 days? Does she convert to Judaism? Because if she wants to convert, why does she have to go through the ceremony? Let her just convert. If she doesn't want to convert, then what happens after the 30 days? She's still a goy. And what if you want to marry her and she doesn't want to marry you? Does she have a say in the matter? There are a lot of difficult questions in terms of just understanding what happens here. Did she convert? Did she not convert? Is she converted against her will? Is she married against her will? Is she a Jewish wife or a non-Jewish wife?
Why was he allowed to do that in the first place?
Now, why is he allowed to do it in the first place? So Rashi brings from Chazal an amazing idea that the Torah is giving you a rare concession to the Yetzer Hara, because passions in time of war are so powerful that if the Torah wouldn't permit it, he would do it anyway. At least some people would do it anyway. And he would do it worse, perhaps rape and the like. So the Torah says, we will allow the sin to be done by regulating it, by circumscribing it, by limiting it, and in that way, it's not, you're not going to break boundaries. Very, very strange. By the way, the Satmar Rebbe used to say, if this is the one case where the Torah says the Yetzer Hara is so strong, you couldn't defeat it, it's mashma that that's never a legitimate argument anywhere else. Like we sometimes do averus and we say, oh, the Yetzer Hara was too strong. It can't be. If the Yetzer Hara would be too strong, the Torah would have allowed you to do it, as it did by Yifas Torah. If the Torah didn't allow you to do it, the Yetzer Hara cannot be so strong. So be it as it may, I'm going to leave, perhaps you'll be disappointed in me. I'm going to leave all of these difficult questions. These are things to think about, and I myself don't have a full answer. All I can tell you is that in the Rishonim, and the Gemara itself discusses it, and there are many different Rishonim that have different commentaries as to what is your status after the 30 days and the like. But I want to share with you a marvelous allegory that the Or HaChaim HaKadosh brings in the name of the Zohar. And the Arizal also elaborate on it. And that is that in effect, the whole parsha of Eishes Shefas Torah is a metaphor for the struggle to reclaim the beauty of our soul. And he starts off this way. You have to pay attention to the words of the psukim. Ki seitzei lamilchama al oyevecha. When you go out to wage war against your enemy, what is the greatest enemy that I have? It is the Yetzer Hara that is within me, that tries to destroy me, that tries to take away my goodness. That is the enemy. That's why Chazal say, Eizehu Gibor, who is a hero who is truly valiant, not the one who conquers countries and cities, HaKovesh, one who conquers, Es Yitzro, is Yetzer Hara. Shlomo HaMelech says, Umoshel Barucho Milochid Ir, one who can rule over his spirit, is greater than the conqueror of the city. And indeed, the Chavos HaLevavos says that a great king came back from a very successful military campaign where he had conquered all sorts of places. And the Chacham came out to greet him. There was a ticker tape parade, a big parade as the Melech comes back, triumphant with great triumph. And the Chacham comes out and says, you have been successful in a small war. Now you must fight the big war, the war against your arrogance, against your gaiva, against your Yetzer Hara, your egotism, your selfishness. So what does the Torah say? When you finally decide to wage war, don't give up hope. Don't be despondent. Unesano Hashem Elokecha Biyadecha. Hashem will deliver that enemy into your hands. That pasuk is a self-contained thought. When you go out to wage war against the Yetzer Hara, rest assured, Hashem will give you the power to vanquish it. Habal Latayer, person seeks purity. Messiah Noso, Hashem will give you the strength. In many ways, the Yetzer Hara within us is more powerful than we can fight. We cannot do it with the natural resources that we have. But when we have the will, Hashem will give us the koach. So what is it that we're lacking? It's never the koach that we're lacking, because the koach we will get, it can only be the will. So when you truly want to fight that enemy, Hashem will put that enemy in your hands. Now then it goes on. This is all from the Or HaChaim. For Isa Bashivya, you will see in captivity to that Yetzer Hara, Eishes Shefas Torah, a beautiful woman. So again, the Zohar HaKadosh says, this is a remez to the neshama of a person that is described as a beautiful woman in terms of its radiance, its beauty, its charm, its goodness. The Yifas Torah is the Eishes Chayil, which has all of the attributes of goodness and avodas Hashem and devotion. But your Yetzer Tov, your neshama, has been captured. It's been covered with dirt. It's in chains. It's unable to express its beauty. because it has been overpowered by the chains of the Yetzer Hara in terms of whatever it might be, our egotism, our selfishness, our depression, whatever it would be. These are like chains that are imprisoning the holiness of that neshama. But now you want to liberate that neshama. Rediscover the goodness in yourself. Vehevesa, I'm just going right here with the psukim. Hevesa el toch beitecha, bring her into your home. Reclaim that goodness. Know that it's in you. Take it back. Now, it then mentions three rituals that this beautiful neshama does. First, she shaves her head. So here, symbolically, shaving the head means disabusing yourself of all of the ideas in your brain that are taking you away from God. Get rid of bad ideas. Now, bad ideas could be a number of things. They could be philosophies of apikorsis, of kfira. They could be attitudes that the only thing that matters in life is hedonism and pleasure. And they could be bad psychological ideas that one has absorbed. Right? One absorbs, perhaps sometimes as a child, negative self-images from whatever source they might be, that I don't count, I'm a failure, I'm not capable of doing things. So the first step is shave your head bald, meaning to say, get rid of all of those ideas that are pulling you down. That also includes bein adam lechavero, things like grudges that I have or complaints against people. What did they say? That when you continue to think badly about a person that hurt you, they are living in your brain rent-free. Why should they have the right to occupy your mind? Right? Kick them out. Evict them. Don't think about it. Did you want to say?
No, I wanted to say, doesn't it also mean that when the woman shaves her head, that she should make herself unattractive?
No, yes. You understand. I'm moving in a totally different plane. In the literal...
Yeah,
this is allegory. Meaning you're 100% correct. The literal meaning of it is that Hashem wants to discourage him from marrying her, so she has to be made unattractive. 100% correct. But this is a different... This is the allegory of it. Now, what about fingernails? So here, the Or HaChaim is going like the opinion that she lets her fingernails grow long. That's how he's following. Now here, what do we do with our hands? We grasp things. Right? So that represents materialism. We want more and more and more and more. When your fingernails are too long, you really cannot grasp things very well. And therefore, in addition to this abusing yourself of ideas, both in terms of philosophical ideas, religious ideas, and negative self-images, grudges, hatred, resentments, you also try to simplify your life, not to be mishuka, not to be sunk in gashmias, materialism, taivas. And then, here's the kicker. She cries, right, that's shaving the hair, letting the fingernails grow. Then the third thing is, she cries for her father and her mother a month of days. Doesn't say 30 days, a month of days. You see why that's important. Father is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our father. Meaning, when I cry over my sins, I try to feel the pain of Hashem, who loved me so much, and therefore I betrayed HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I cry over the betrayal of my father. Mother is the Jewish people, like the motherland. And one knows that when I sin, it's not just me. A person might say, oh, I sin, so that's, I'm gonna go to hell. What's it your business? The answer is no. Under Kol Yisrael, Arevin Zelazah, the failures of any one of us impact on the entire Jewish people. Everyone knows the famous mashal of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Imagine a person on a boat with a lot of people, and there's a hole under my seat, and the water is coming in, and they want to fix the hole, and I said, don't, mind your own business, it's under my seat, it's none of your affair. The answer is, if enough water goes under my seat, we're all going to sink. That's Kol Yisrael Arevin Zelazah. When I sin, it is not just a betrayal of Hashem, but I am betraying the entire Jewish people. Everybody gets dragged down because of my sins. I'm sorry, did you want to say? I'm talking about I understand, but remember, okay, I see people are not accustomed to allegory perhaps. The allegory here of the woman with the beautiful soul is said to be your neshama, your soul. And therefore, we are not talking about a non-Jewish person anymore. We are talking about your soul being reclaimed. In other words, essentially, she is regarded as a captive in non-Jewish values. The non-Jewish society has taken your soul captive, and you're now trying to get her back, right? That's the allegory. Again, this is clearly not the pshat of the psukim. Okay? No one is saying this is the explanation, literally, in the Torah, but this is the symbolic meaning. Now, the final kicker is great. How long does she cry to her father about her father and her mother? She cries for a month of days. The Zohar says this is the month of Elul that is set aside to be the period of tshuva and reflection. And then you are able to marry her, meaning you get reunited with your neshama. And of course, this would not be negative. In other words, again, it doesn't fit the idea of ben sora mora afterwards, because if one accomplishes this process, then it is a good process. But I want to raise one final question, which really needs much more time. I'm going to have to talk about this more bi'arichas, and that is the following. There are in halacha two types of wars that the Jewish people wage. One war is called milchames mitzvah. A milchames mitzvah is a mandatory, obligatory war that must fight. We must. The Rambam says there are three types of wars that are called milchames mitzvah. One type of war is the war to eradicate the seven nations who inhabited Canaan, but they're extinct, so that's not going to apply today. The second is the war of Amalek. And according to the Rambam, as a nation, Amalek is either extinct or unidentifiable. So that doesn't apply today. Category number three, unfortunately, is a war that does apply to this very day. And of course, we are recently experienced it. That is a war to defend the Jewish people from enemies that try to destroy us. And that is called a milchames mitzvah. Now you'll notice, interestingly enough, that one thing the Rambam didn't count. The Rambam did not count as a milchames mitzvah a war to conquer the territory of Eretz Yisrael. In other words, the Rambam defines milchames mitzvah only as a war to defend Jews from an enemy that's coming after us. He does not count a war to simply conquer territory in Eretz Yisrael that's not yet under our control. This is to be distinguished from Ramban. Ramban actually adds a fourth category of milchames mitzvah, and that is even an aggressive, proactive war to conquer territory within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban considers that to be a component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. People make a mistake. Everyone knows that the Ramban's shita is that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a positive mitzvah. Living in Israel is a mitzvah. That's the Ramban's opinion. But people don't realize that a component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is not just living in Israel, but it is to conquer all territory that is within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. And of course we know that those territories are much larger than the present state of Israel. Now, Rambam does not count conquest of Eretz Yisrael as a mitzvah, precisely because the Rambam does not hold Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, and therefore milchames mitzvah would only apply to a defensive context. Now, within a defensive context, of course, there's all sorts of subtleties. A defensive war might be preemptive. You might attack an enemy first in order to prevent him from attacking you. You may move on to his territory, meaning halacha recognizes that defense doesn't mean you have to wait until the enemy actually kills some of your people. Now, there is a milchames mitzvah. Now, what's important about the category of milchames mitzvah, and this is, I don't want to get too political here, is that we read in Parsha Shoftim that certain people are exempt from military service. Right? We have four categories of people who are exempt. One is a person who betrothed a woman, erisin, and did not yet consummate the marriage. The second is a person who had a vineyard, but because of orla, 3 years, he did not yet eat the fruit. The third category is a person who built a house or bought a house and did not yet live in it. And the fourth is a person who's afraid. Now, there's a machlokas. Is that I'm afraid or I have sins and I'm afraid? Now, those are four categories who are exempt from war. But the Mishnah in Sota says that those people are exempt only from optional wars, which I'll explain in a moment. But Milchemes Mitzvah, everybody must go out to fight. There are no exemptions for Milchemes Mitzvah. Now, what's interesting is, this raises the following question, which I don't want to get myself in big trouble. And that is, if we assume that the modern wars that the state of Israel fights are generally, really always, defensive wars, either preemptively or defensively, then halachically they would be characterized as Milchemes Mitzvah. If halachically they are characterized as Milchemes Mitzvah, then halacha does not recognize exemptions. So this gets into the problem of yeshiva students and the like. I mean, I don't want to get into that issue, but that would be the paradigm. Now, I do want to point out too, that the characterization of modern Israeli wars as Milchemes Mitzvah actually does not depend on your view of the state of Israel. Meaning, even if, theoretically, you would be in a two-way character person. Let's assume you believe, it's not my belief, but let's assume one would believe that it is prohibited to have a state of Israel until the coming of Mashiach. Let's assume you take that belief. But so what? What makes Milchemes Mitzvah is not the protection of the state. What makes Milchemes Mitzvah is the protection of the Jews who live in the state. So even if one is against Medinat Yisrael, it would still be on Milchemes. I mean, Milchemes Mitzvah doesn't even have to be in Israel. Let's assume, I don't consider, you know, this to be Eretz, you know, well, of course it's Eretz, but it's not Medinat Yisrael. So what? If you had the situation in New York or Texas or Europe or Syria, right? So it's a very interesting question. One has to think about, one has to discuss, and that is the issue of Milchemes Mitzvah. Okay, now that's one war. The other war is called Milchemes Rishus. What is Milchemes Rishus? Optional wars. Wars of expansion. Well, when you first hear that, that sounds very odd. You mean the Torah allows a Jewish state to simply aggressively attack another country without provocation? Let's say we'd like to conquer Morocco. Right? So we just wage war against Morocco and take it over, or Cyprus, whatever it is. Maybe the Rabbanit is tired of Chilonim going to Cyprus to get married and circumvent the Rabbanit. Let's conquer Cyprus. We'll take a half an hour. You know. So the question becomes, I mean, are we allowed to do that? So here's the thing. You have to know that although in theory halacha does make allowance for Milchemes Rishut, in practice it's impossible. And the reason is, number one, such an optional war requires, number one, consent of the Sanhedrin, which we don't have. But more importantly, it requires the prophetic authorization of the Urim V'Tumim. Which means, you can do it if God says it's okay. So, as a practical matter therefore, unless Hashem gave you Rishus B'Nevuah, can't do it. And that's why today, it's obviously the case, that any halachic validity of a war can only rest on defensive grounds. It would be halachically totally impermissible for a Jewish state to have a war of aggression, and that would be considered murder. Any soldiers on either side that was killed in an unjustified war of aggression would spiritually be treated as shvichas damim. It would be murder. There would be no hetero. Okay. Now, I know some rabbis like to do this. I never did it, but I'll do it today because I'm running out of time. They like to end their drasha with a question that you can think about for a week, because I do want to come back to this. So you'll have a good question, although that'll be 2 weeks from the parsha. And that is, which war is Eishes Shefas Toar talking about? When you go out to war against your enemy, is it Milchemes Mitzvah? Or is it Milchemes Rishus? Rashi says, from the Sifri, that the war that we must be talking about must be an optional war, because only in optional wars do we take captives. In a war against the seven nations of Canaan, or against Amalek, we have to eradicate men, women, and child. And if you're taking a captive, now, There is one question on Rashi, which is not my big question. That is, well, wait a second here. But Rashi is correct in saying we can't be talking about an Amalek war or a Seven Nations of Canaan war. But that doesn't lead to the conclusion we have to be talking about an optional war, because there's a third possibility. In a defensive war, we are certainly permitted to take captives. So how does Rashi get from we can't be talking about Amalek and Seven Nations, therefore we're talking about optional war, why can't we be talking about a defensive war where we're allowed to take prisoners? That's a technical kasha on Rashi. I think that's a good kasha. But I want to ask a philosophical kasha. And that is, if Rashi concludes that the entire parsha of Eishes Shefas Toar is talking about an optional war, here is our problem. It doesn't fit the allegory. If I were to ask you, our struggle against the Yetzer Hara, would we call that a mitzvah war or an optional war? Yeah, if you want to do it, do it. If you don't want to do it, forget about it. We would certainly describe it as a mitzvah war. So we have an apples and oranges problem here. Why would the Torah convey the message of fighting the Yetzer Hara through an allegory that is referring to a war that you don't have to fight at all if you don't want to? Wouldn't it have made more sense to concretize this imagery in the context of Milchemes Mitzvah? Okay? Now, maybe we're mixing apples and oranges because we're taking the halachic ruling of Rashi and we're applying it to a metaphor and to an allegory. But if you take it all as one unit, it's very, very strange that the greatest Milchemes Mitzvah of our lives is in a parsha that is talking about optional wars. Okay? So that's the question I'm going to leave you with, and I will talk about that next week. Have a good day.